All right, we're live. Hi, this is William Ramsey. Welcome to William Ramsey Investigates. On tonight's show, I have a very special guest. He reached out to me. I'm glad he reached out to me because he wrote a book published 2020. The title of that book is Demons Among Us, Shocking Real Life Stories from the Paranormal. His name is M.R. Gorga. And it's really just an interesting book. And it brought a subject of interest to me, which is kind of the New England history. And he can talk more about that, about some of the stuff, stories that I've never really heard. Particularly this one that happened in New England prior to the Salem witch trials. But he wrote a very detailed book on a very, I think, very important subjects, too, that are contained in each of these chapters. But he can talk more about that. So, M.R. Gorga, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Well, thanks for reaching out to me, and thanks for agreeing to the interview. For people who may not have heard of you, can talk a little bit about your background and what led up to the publication of this book, Demons Among Us.
Sure. Well, I have a very extensive writing career. It started in magazines and journalism, and carried over into advertising, copywriting for and marketing materials for many, many years. And this is my first publication, and I'm hoping to scare the bejesus out of your listeners.
Okay. Well, let's start from right the beginning. Like, what? I mean, it's kind of a difficult subject. What brought you into this kind of paranormal subject?
Well, I mean, I have a number of reasons why I wrote the book. What brought me into it was that, you know, I have suffered lots of demonic attacks and demonic assaults. And this was the answer to a string of assaults that took place some time ago. It was like a week or two string of just nightly assailings, midnight chokings, evil whisperings, chest suppressions, taking my breath, choking, things of that nature. And this was my answer to these demonic forces, so to say, as I wanted to open the eyes of my readers in order to really awaken them to all the dark forces that are actually happening all around them without them knowing it.
And you use the term sleep paralysis. So you've had personal experiences of sleep paralysis plus other events, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I think what people deem as sleep paralysis is not sleep paralysis at all. And I say that because what this comes with is so altogether different. It comes with terrifying dark fear, meaning you really feel the room fill with this black presence. And it comes with a paralyzing terror that you can't speak for a minute. And so it's different than sleep paralysis. This is demonic assault.
And when did they start? Has this been a recurring event for you in your life, or something that happened fairly recently?
Yeah, these happen sporadically. And it first started when I became a follower of Christ, a believer. And one of my first times ever I've ever prayed in my life. You know, it's not something I grew up with or anything like that. And it started immediately after, within the first couple days of becoming a believer. And one of the first instances that I write in the book is I tell the account of, you know, what happened my first time in prayer. And that was I was in prayer for the first time, and I could feel something enter the room, and I could feel something behind me, behind my right ear. And I kind of like scrunched my shoulder to my ear to, you know, just to shoo it away, you know. And then a voice spoke from behind me and says, you might have gone to God, but you belong to me. You will always be mine. I'm never going to let you go. And the voice wasn't the voice of a monster like you hear in Hollywood, or this hoarse, gravelly, monstery voice. The voice was like silver, liquid smooth, even like regal or princely. but underneath you sensed this undercurrent of cunning evil, and that was the first introduction into this world.
And when did you become a Christian? What year was that?
Right. It was, I became a follower of Christ at, 20 years ago. Yeah.
So you, and then, I mean, you're in your church too. So you're definitely involved in fellowshipping. And how did you respond to this demonic event that happened to you?
Well, it's like they go on the attack. I go on the attack. And so, what happened is in the instances I also make reference in the book, as well as I lead a prayer night in the ministry. And so at the end of this, and we're all kind of gathered in a circle, and I said, I brought it up. I said what was going on, and I said, is anybody else experiencing these kinds of things? And then one by one, everyone's hands started to go up. And so that's when I realized that it wasn't just me under attack. It was the body of Christ. It was the believers who were all under attack and all at the same time. But nobody wanted to say anything because everyone thought that they were going to be called crazy. And that's when I kind of like, you know, went on the attack. And that was the moment leading up to, you know, the answer to these kinds of incidents is demons among us. And that's why I wrote the book.
And so, but when you're saying in your prayer group 13, do you think that extrapolates to even larger groups, not just your prayer group, but larger, maybe other Christian groups as well have had similar experiences to you, but they don't talk about it?
I would imagine. I mean, anybody who's kind of really operating or functioning in any kind of authority, as a believer, then you can expect to be attacked. And if you only get attacked if you're a threat. If you're not being attacked and you're a believer, something's a little off.
Right. Well, because I've had experiences of sleep paralysis. They're nothing as extreme as somebody talking to me, but I've definitely woken up and like pressure on your chest, definitely yeah. Something very strange. And that's actually not that, it's not as uncommon as people might see, just for that same reason. A lot of people don't want to get tagged with the label.
That's what I'm hoping to kind of open up that discussion, because, I put a great quote in there at the very beginning of the book by a Chinese philosopher. And he says, if men since the beginning of time until now have heard these voices and seen the bodies of, deceased men, then how can we say these things don't exist? And my argument is this. So it's from the beginning of time until now, over generations and generations and generations, thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of people have experienced these types of things. It's mathematically impossible that every one of these individuals is crazy.
Right. That's a good point. And then they're happening in different cultures, different eras, right? So
yes,
it's happening all over the world. So the belief in evil spirits and good spirits is actually the default. It's actually much more common, maybe not in the modern world, but definitely in the ancient world. And you start off the book also with a chapter on this sequence that took place in New England prior to the witch trials. Can you talk about that? The Salem witch?
Yeah, the story is actually, it's really incredible. It's between a minister and a 16-year-old maid. And the minister this is a very, very small town of early New England. It's a wilderness community, not very big. But the story is that, his maid started exhibiting signs, strange signs, and signs that the minister thought may be demonic. And so he started to keep a journal every day. So he wrote down everything that was going on for almost about 90 days. He gave a real blow by blow of all of these things that were happening to this young girl, and screamings and supernatural strength beyond her years, and just all of these different things going on in this young girl that he really tried to get to the bottom of these things, and he had a physician come look at her. So he did something really revolutionary for that time. You know, Salem witch trials were quick to pin people with, you know, witch, you know, as a witch or, you know, in league with the devil. What he did was he really took this really pastoral concern, and he's like, well, let's try to check off the boxes here and let's see if it's anything medically. And it, you know, and at that time it would have been palsy or dropsy or what was called the frenetic melancholy. And it was none of those things. And, you know, he would have had to have come to the conclusion that this was possibly the work of Satan.
Right. And his name was Samuel Willard. And it's interesting that we were talking kind of in the pre-show, these guys really kept very good records. They were all writers and they're always trying to keep a record of a lot of their stuff. So there's a lot of that stuff accessible. How did you find this story?
You know, it's, yeah, I get asked a lot. I was just reading through something. I can't remember the exact book, but it made mention of this case, but it was just glossed over. And I saw that, you know, it said like, you know, this happened and that happened and dot, dot, dot. And so I said, well, what's between those dots? And so when I started unfolding this thing, it started unfolding and I was like, there's a journal and there's extra resources and I'm like, this is incredible. And it's just been lost to time. And so I really, you know, believe I've brought to life this thing that has really just kind of slipped through the cracks of history.
Blown the dust off the book. Yeah. Just pulled it up. Cause it's really fascinating and very detailed. You include excerpts from the writings and things in your books, but also it may be the presumptions of our age to gloss over stories like this, the scientism or scientifical, and also the way that the witch trials are viewed, also that they were hysterics, right? Or what's your view with this story in context with the Salem witch trials?
Well, something started the witch trials. Okay. So it was, you know, the ministers at the time, Paris, his two children, I think they're two daughters. And they started having what they called at that time fits, what we would call seizures. But then they would say, we saw the specter of so-and-so and she's pinching me and she's pricking me with needles and things of that nature. I actually tend to believe that there was an original start because knowing how the demonic works, of course he would go after the pastor's kids, right? And so I tend to believe there was an initial outset, but I think what happened was there was a hysteria that took over that people really started to kind of buy into, and you know, mass panic creates mass panic, you know, so it's and irrational behaviors and thoughts and processes, even the court processes where it didn't sometimes take normal course because there was hysteria. So right. But I think there was an initial onset that was originally had a demonic thing to it. And then a lot of the stuff just became natural hysterical phenomena that you know, takes over society in any kind of mass anxiety inducing thing, you know?
Well, it's interesting you bring that up because it almost can be transposed to the present day, this concept or loaded term of a satanic panic. But if you look at some of those initial elements, there oftentimes there's some type of occultism in some of these, like child, there's a few at least that I know of these child daycare centers that had occultism. There's some in McMartin. So then it spawns this panic. So you almost see this almost strange phenomenon happening at the Salem witch trials in present day. And they're obviously witch hunts, that term is still bandied about. But
yeah, I mean, there's, you know, nothing, there's nothing new under the sun. And we tend to think, well, these people were just these, you know, old and they did thinking and, you know, antiquated in thought and whatever. The human nature never changes. And so the same human nature we have now is the same human nature we had back then. And we're still susceptible to these mass kind of Hysterias.
Yeah, no, humanity's definitely is capable of falling into mass hysteria. There's actually a book written about it, about the history of human mass hysteria. But there's still the truth. You still see the same themes. And even in this story, the woman's name was Elizabeth Knapp, the 16-year-old girl. Mm-hmm. It's almost like the same story of the witch trials, but the same themes. You hear the Malleus Maleficarum, the witch's hammer. Yes. You still see these remarkable things. You also talk about a literal witch, Rebecca Greensmith, who got burned at the stake. So there's all kinds of strange things happening back in the beginnings of New England.
Yeah, I mean, there's a very, very colorful history of witchcraft in the world, and this, you know, the supernatural roots of America, of our nation, are rooted in very, very supernatural things, good and evil, and you know, when it comes to that witch, I couldn't put everything in there, you know, I had to, you know, kind of edit and things like that. But that story itself is an incredible, incredible story. And that was a story of, I think a Connecticut witchcraft story, which Salem wasn't the first witch panic. It was actually Connecticut. And I think in the 1650s, I don't have all my things in front of me, but that was the first witch panic was actually Connecticut.
Right. It's actually the first ones. And then you can go back to Old World, where they had literal burning times, they were burning witches, and there's all kinds of witch trials that happened in England. And there's, well, I think it was King James wrote the King James Bible, but he also wrote something about witches. Like, he really thought he's under attack from witches in his life.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, he had wrote some of the first laws on it. You know, the Malleus Maleficarum in Europe, Malleus Maleficarum was used, and the laws of King James were used, but when we came over to America, we used Bernard, and we used Perkins, and we used those for to really derive how the jurymen should respond and detect a witch.
Right. So they had these tests, but it's really incredible, and it's all this story that you include of Elizabeth Knapp.
Yeah,
has so many similarities to the Salem witch trials. It's almost like the same thing. People came to see what was going on. There's writing, there's curious. And the Salem witch trials had, like, was it Cotton Mather or Increase Mather? I don't remember.
It was Increase.
Increase, right.
Increase, so. I think. I want to say Increase, but obviously, I think Increase and Cotton kind of operated at the same time. But it was Increase who had, you know, the most influence over that Massachusetts colony at that time. So I want to believe it's Increase.
Right. And this was in Groton. So this, at the time, Groton was actually the hinterlands, or out in the, you know, in the forest, in the sticks, I guess, would be at that time.
Groton was in the middle of nowhere. Yeah. I mean, it was literally a forest frontier town in the middle of a howling wilderness. And when I say wilderness, it's trees, it's not desert. But it's, you know, it's, you're living in the woods and with nothing around for miles and miles except Indians who may want to raid your colony. So, you know, so.
Right. And you mentioned that the King William's War or King James War, I can't remember which it was. It was a huge war right around that time, right?
King Philip's War.
King Philip's War.
1675. Yeah. Yeah. So it's lots of interesting history and dynamic going on at one time in this little community.
Yeah. Have you seen the modern movie called The Witch? Because it takes place in New England. It's getting brought to mind.
Yeah, I have. It's one of my, you know, one of my favorite movies. And I would really like to commend that director, because he really did nail that period. And, you know, even to the point where he wanted to build the same way that they built, meaning that he wouldn't use like circular saws because they would leave like circular patterns in the, you know, in the wood and whatever. So he really, really, he really, really did go the extra mile in bringing that period. So the Witch historically is one of my favorite movies.
Yeah, no. And it's a really, you make that great point. It really was a historical piece. Like,
yes,
it really set it.
You know, and it's funny because on the outset of this thing, you know, I can't remember the director's name right now, and I'm sorry because it's such a great movie. But it took him, I think he said like 5 years to do. And I said, wow, why did it take so long? And then I started delving into this research, and here I am 3 years into it. I started laughing. I said, now I know, because there is so much that you have to know in order to bring this thing to life. You have to know the language. You have to know the dress. You have to know the culture. You have to know the mindset. How to, you know, what was the class structure? What was this? And how did they think about that? And before you know it, years have passed and you're just scratching the surface of understanding the period and it's in all of its nuances in order to bring it to life.
Yeah. And I think that you show that, like, these are Puritans. They have a different sensibility. But the director's name was Robert Eggers.
Yes. Thank you. Robert Eggers. Yes. I'm sorry, Robert Eggers.
No, so he gets a little shout out. But yeah, it was interesting. Was it the same? Was it also that they had the devil's book they were supposed to sign? Was that in the Knapp story or was that just Salem? I don't recall.
Yeah, that was actually in the Knapp story, but it was also one of those things that was, you know, it became a thing of legend, you know, signing the devil's book. And you heard all of these testimonies saying that, you know, even the specters of people were appearing and they wanted me to put my hand to the book or to set my hand to the book. And so when this was a thing of legend, and at that time, everybody would have known of this legend. So in the case of this story, yeah, he wanted her to sign the contract or the compact or the covenant.
Right. And that still happens. I mean, there was the story of Gilles de Rais, and they had the same thing. They had the same satanic book and you had to sell it with your blood. And that's a Bavarian culture. That's 200 years before this in Western France.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy? Like he doesn't really change his tactics. And in some form or fashion, there's always some sort of blood covenant, so to say.
Right. Yeah. No, it's really something else. Yeah, but it just carried. And did she get the moniker Witch of Groton? I think that was her, or was it Rebecca Greensmith? I don't remember.
No, it was her.
It was her. So yeah, you see.
Because you know it's, you know, rumors fly fast, you know, and it was the same thing with Salem, where you know the first examination took place on a leap year. It was February 29th, I think, it's 1692, and I think in February or March, right? February, obviously. And so this, or right around there. So that very first examination, in Salem, there was actually a public, meeting that morning. So there was already a lot of people, but then when this news kind of came out that this new fascinating gossip worthy, alarming thing was happening, they're going to investigate the witches, they think they're witches. Well, then, you know, there was not room enough to really house everybody to kind of watch this, the initial investigation of these, I think it was the three, I want to say Sarah Osborne, Sarah Good, and I want to say Ann Putnam. But
And they had the witch right from the Caribbean, the Tituba.
Oh, yeah. Well, though I think those
are not a witch, but somebody
It's Tituba. So they were examining Tituba too. Yeah.
Right. I think they were doing some kind of searing with like an egg, like they were cracking eggs. They were doing something at that time, which was rich.
Was doing something, I think, like making, you know, cakes with like urine or something. And I don't remember the exact details. But yeah, I think that she was just so accustomed to doing what she was doing that she really didn't even kind of take it as witchcraft because she was like Caribbean or whatever. Right. So it Caribbean just might have been like, oh, this is what we've always done and thought nothing of it. But, you know, in the period of that day, it would have been like, holy crap, she's doing what?
And in your intro, not to go back from the story, but you talked a lot about this interest is still real today. You talk about these films that have sold hundreds of millions of dollars in box office receipts.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, because there's such a, a dark fascination seemingly within all of us, right? There's like, you know, when you talk about, you know, William Friedkin's The Exorcist, or you talk about Amityville Horror and the Conjuring series. I mean, these really kind of tap into some real dark thing in us that sparks this chord within us that, you know, that resonates within us. And even if it's this dark thing, there's a fascination to it.
And I think that, like, your experience in your prayer group, I think that there's more people with paranormal stories. So that's probably one of the reasons why they just don't discuss it. Because you really start talking to some people, they'll tell you some ghost stories. I've heard very same people tell me very literal ghost stories that I don't think they were lying. Like, they literally experienced some spirit involvement. And but I know, like, The Exorcist, for example, was based upon a book called Possessed.
Yep.
About a kid who was screwing around with a Ouija board.
Yes.
And it got possessed.
Yeah. Yeah. Listen, you play with the devil, you know,
yeah,
you tamper with the devil's toys.
Do you know what's interesting? Like, my family's from the Midwest, and the Jesuit priest who was at that case was still teaching, I think, at one of the Jesuit universities, Creighton or something like that. Like, that guy was real. Like, it was a real event.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And there's, you know, when you start reading, like, some of the, like, real possession cases, I have them in my file somewhere. I can't remember exactly what they're called, but just, you know, some of the real possession cases of people, you know, not just levitating, but, like, levitating, like, they're on the, you know, bent over a horse, and the guy's like, fuck you, you know, it's like, oh, my God, it's really, really intense stuff, you know.
Very intense. Yeah. So that those possession stories, I don't know. I've heard stories like some are real, I think, for sure.
Pardon my French, by the way.
What's that?
Oh, it's okay. Pardon my French, by the way.
I've already been kicked off of YouTube. If they do it again, yeah, I don't really care. I really would recommend people go read that part of the book, because me as somebody who loves history, it was really fascinating. And I told you about that. Story about writing. I wrote a very lengthy paper about New England religious history, and a guy by the name of James Davenport. So people can check that out too if they're interested. I actually read it into my podcast if people want to listen to that. But that's just a certain small part of a very long book, and you cover certain other topics, not just this American witch story, but you also talk about kind of your experiences. I mean, do you want to talk more about what you personally experienced?
Yeah. One of the stories I wrote in the book is chapter 3. And it really was, to this point, one of the scariest moments or scariest encounters I've ever, you know, had to face. And the story is that I had lost my job at the marketing department of a local newspaper. And that kind of forced me to move out of my apartment downtown. And I had moved into a townhouse, two-story townhouse that one of my family members had left or, you know, kind of abandoned. And so I was like, okay, well, let me move in there. Right. And so I get there and, you know, now I haven't seen the property in a long time. So when I pull up, you know, the grass was overgrown and the fence was dilapidated and raw wood and colorless, and it was even creaking on its hinge in the breeze. And it was like the Munsters live there, you know, or, you know, the Addams family. And then I opened the door, and there looked as though someone still lived there. Like, there's toys on the floor. You know, there's bills on the table, there's milk in the fridge, there's stuff in the sink. And I'm like, it looks like they just went to the store to grab something to come back. I mean, that's literally how it looked. And one night I was in bed, and I smell this smell coming through the home. And I think it's coming from the downstairs. And I'm like, well, what is that? I mean, it smells like, you know, it smells like something rotten, and like a chemical note, something like rotten, like, I don't know, garbage with a chemical note to it. I'm like, what is that? So I'm smelling around the house, and I go downstairs, and I'm smelling around the downstairs, and I can't find it. So I'm like, I look up at the air vent, and I get up on a chair, and I put my face to the air vent, and it's coming from the air vent, and it's blowing. This rot is blowing directly into my face. And I'm like, okay. And so I have this sneaking suspicion that something is going on. And so then I got off the chair, and I cut the power to the AC from the utility box, cut off the electric, right? I mean, the AC, get back up on the chair, and it's still blowing into my face without any kind of mechanical assistance. It's just, now it's just blowing on its own into my face. Right. And, and so I get off, and I'm like, I know something's going on. Right. And anyway, so what am I going to do? So I go back up the stairs, and I go to sleep. And while I'm laying there, I see a shift in the light from behind my eyelids. And, from out of the darkness, I turned over, and so, but out of the darkness, I hear something, a voice call my name, and it says, "Michael," real long, withdrawn, serpentine, and it sounded as close as it was far away. So it sounded both far away and near. And so when I rolled back over and opened my eyes, there was a figure in black at my bedside. And it was tall, lanky, with crooked shoulders, and I could see its face deep in the back of its cowl and the back of its hood. And its head was crooked, and it had a broad smile smiling down at me. And I can feel this penetrating hatred and anger, not just on me, but it was inside my body, this hatred. And it was, you could feel it like boiling tar on the inside. And I looked down, and I could see its hand was crawling up physically on my chest, crawling up, headed towards my throat. What was interesting was its gown, its robe, was that when I looked down at the bottom of the robe, it wasn't like tatters or anything like that. It was like, you know, neat rectangular, like rectangles, like blinds, like in Florida, we have these blinds, right? And so it was like neat rectangular, but it was, the color went from like dark, dark gray to black. And the further the layer, the darker it got. And it was waving like it was like underwater. Like there's this real beauty to its movement, which I thought was kind of a strange thought to have at that moment. And so there was this real fluidness to its gown, or, you know, its clothing, cloak. But that was the first time I've ever felt, you know, seen the actual presence, but felt it on my physical form. So that was the most terrifying moment for me, was to actually see
the physical response or something. Yeah.
Yeah. The spiritual manifestation into the physical, and actually literally feel it as if I was being touched by somebody, or if I was touching somebody else, as real as that, crawling up my chest. And that was the most terrifying.
So did the entity leave you, or what happened next?
Well, when I was able to speak, because these things take away your breath, like they take away your ability to speak or cry out. And, but these things have no power. If you're a believer, you have authority, a believer in Christ, mind you, if you're a believer in Christ, you have the authority given by Christ to bind these things, or to expel these things. And that's what I did. I called on the name of Jesus, and then I just watched this thing kind of like evaporate like a mist. It was very bizarre. It just kind of like like melted into a mist and it was gone.
Wow. So yeah, you've definitely had some definite experiences. But yeah, that was a great story. I know somebody who was in a house that was definitely kind of haunted, and he was a musician. So he had guitars and he went to bed, and one night he heard the guitar adjust like up on the wall. He had it facing a wall and it just went. So he got up. So he's like, oh, that's weird. Something must've happened. So he got up, turned off the light, turned on the light, went over to his guitar, put it back where it was, went back into bed. 5 minutes later, it did the same thing again. He never slept in that room again.
Oh my God. Did it start wailing? That would have been awesome if it started wailing.
I don't know.
Solo or something.
They're just weird. Some of these weird older houses, you know, they have people walk up downstairs and things like that. It's very strange. But what else would you like to cover? I mean, we're kind of coming close to the end of 40 minutes. What, ML, would you like to? There's a lot more in this book. You cover pharmakia, cover pornography, you talk about emasculating manhood.
Yeah, there's a lot. And the reason why I put that in there is because demonic possession is the extreme form of the demonic manifestations, but it's the everyday things that are going on that people don't know about. So I had to talk about these things where it's like these demons are spirits and, you know, they have names. Whatever their names are, you have a name, I have a name, what they're more known for is their actual function. So when you talk about spirits, like spirits of depression, spirits of fear, spirits of suicide, spirits of anxiety, spirits of greed, and on and on and on. And so I talk about some of the greatest spirits in operation today. And that's just scratching the surface, but I just wanted to bring to light what these things function every day without your knowing, and they have influence over individual lives, and people don't know that they're actually have these things or actually have any kind of influence in their
right. life. No, I know what you're saying. I mean, it's interesting. You said demons feed on fear, so you don't want to be afraid. And not let these things, and this pharmakia is like almost a form of witchcraft. Some of these.
Well, yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Well, that was.
It really is. I would say it's witchcraft, actually.
Well, it is because it's, and I tie it back to, you know, ancient ritual and mysticism, because what they were using them to induce spirits and to hear voices was that they were using the poppy or the opium. A form of opium in order to induce, you know, to hear these voices. And so the thing is, what connects that to now is that now that, you know, we use poppy, but we use a derivative of the poppy. And so what people are doing is they're taking these pharmaceuticals with the same exact properties that they had to induce voices back in those rituals are the same things that we're taking today. And we have people saying, I'm hearing voices. And I have the story. I relay a story of a 12-year killer who killed his grandparents because he was on Zoloft or one of those. Yeah. One of those drugs. And he said, I'm hearing voices. And the only way to stop it, because it started going faster and faster, kill. Right. And he goes, the only way to stop it was to obey what it was commanding me to do. And so I wrote that as to say, if, you know, because you want to tag that person as crazy if they're hearing voices. And I wrote this to say that, you know, it's time to stop thinking that people are crazy and take this more seriously, that there may be a spiritual component to it. Because like what the pharmaceutical industry is doing is many times they're trying to medicate a spiritual problem with natural means, and it's never going to heal.
Very, very well said. Very well said. Yeah, it's really true. A lot of these problems are spiritual. If you can avoid antidepressants, for heaven's sake, please do it. Don't you? There's all so many better things to do, better ways to solve that problem, and also put you in a fugue state. And almost all of those shooters, all those mass shooters, the common denominator is pharmakia. It's not even recreational drugs. It's something they got from pharmaceutical industry. It's incredible.
Because what it does is back in like exactly what it did back 3,000 years ago, open you up to voices and demonic voices, spiritual voices, is the same thing it's doing now, is because that opium or the derivative of it is utilized to open up those pathways to
things that you're not, that the government, the Bible forbids that, right? Forbids pharmacy.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's not like we have to be doing rituals to open up ourselves to spirits. And, you know, it's, you know, you just got to be doing certain, you know, these certain drugs open up these pathways and make you vulnerable and susceptible to demonic assault.
Yeah. Terrible things are the outcome. So I think that's an important theme and a really great book. Really enjoyed reading the parts that I did. Demons Among Us, Shocking Real Life Stories from the Paranormal, ML, Gorga. Where's the best place to find the book?
Right now it's on Amazon. You can get it on Kindle and print version. I always recommend the print version because I personally just like to hold something, but people tend to want to turn this cover down at night, so you can have fun doing that. They don't want it to be creeped out, so that was a surprising thing. But yeah, you can find me on Amazon. On social media, you can find me on Instagram at m.r.gorga, and at Facebook, you can find me at M.R. Gorga.
M.R. Gorga, that's right. It's M.R. Gorga. The book was published in 2020. Again, the title is, I highly recommend this book, Demons Among Us, Shocking Real-Life Stories from the Paranormal. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Take care.
Thanks.
All right. So this